Accession number 27185, reel 47.
Major Barras, reel 47. You were saying there are other things you had to do while you were at Warminster.
Yeah, well, we had to. There were strikes, national dock strike, and the Smithfield meat strike. Now, on reflection, I'm not sure it wasn't at Bury St Edmunds. I don't think we would have been used at Warminster. I'm sorry to have to go back, I guess, but these things occurred to me as we. And we had to send troops in, down to the dock strike to continue offloading and loading, helping to load ships. I can't remember whether it was Southampton they went to. I think it was Southampton. And then, of course, the Smithfield market, we had to, we sent some troops there to help with the meat, loading meat, I suppose. But it's rather misty in my mind. I know I went down to both locations to see what was happening and whether it was being done all right and they got enough troops. But there were other troops being used as well, so I think we were only there for a short time when we were relieved.
Was there any trouble about that, about the strike breaking?
No. No, I think once the army's called in, it's like the sort of fire brigade when they go on strike, these green goddesses come out, don't they? There doesn't seem to be any problem. Nobody worries too much about bringing in the army in an emergency. I think they accept that. What they don't like is bringing in non-union civilians.
What about the attitude of the soldiers, many of whom would have been conscripts?
Oh, I don't think they worried about it. They just, by this time, they'd... I mean, they may be, we didn't look upon them as conscripts. Mm. We looked upon them as normal soldiers in the regiment, and we treated them as such. And when they came in, directly they came in, they were treated like regular soldiers. We had to bear in the back of our minds that a lot of them were still young and had come straight from home and that sort of thing, so you had to be careful not to be overdo it in the way of discipline in the early days, and to be sympathetic if they had problems. But by and large, they turned out absolutely splendidly.
What sort of problems did they have then, if they were young and away from home for the first time?
Well, some of them were homesick when they first came, but then we didn't get that so much as they did at the depot. Mm. I can't remember. I think they said they... Of course, some of them had just got married, and some had left jobs, which losing a lot of money on, and that sort of thing, which used to bug them a bit. But we didn't get any sort of, I don't remember any sort of, I can't take this sort of attitude. I think they all buckled down, as far as I can remember, they all buckled down to it. And once they realised they were part of an efficient going concern, there was no way out. I think they obeyed orders and did as they were told. Eventually, they came to the point where they were part of the regiment, and they were in teams and their platoons, and they got friends. Of course, I think it's a mistake to think that when you put somebody into uniform, he becomes a clone. He doesn't. My experience is you put people in uniforms, they fight to get their personality out. And it draws out personalities in people which they probably never knew they had before, in order to get to know their peers and to appear different from their peers. Otherwise, they're going to all look the same and be the same, which of course they're not. And they made a special effort, I think, a lot of them, to exert themselves and develop their personalities.
Did you have any of them who converted from national service to regular service?
There were some, and not a great many, but at the end of their time, some of them did sign up for... I think, I can't remember, but it was 3 years. I think it was down to sort of 3 years then.
Were these the sort of chaps who might have joined anyway as regular soldiers if National Service hadn't been important?
Oh, I don't know. I think they just enjoyed the life and wanted to continue with it. And didn't have any particular sort of necessity to get back to something in civilian life. I mean, if they got a job waiting for them in civilian life, then obviously they would want to get back to it. But there were one or two, and took them on. Some of them made lance corporal and corporal. I can't remember we had any sergeants. Of course, we had officers as well of the National Service, and short service officers. So we had quite a mix. But it worked. It wouldn't have worked had we stuck to 1 year, I don't think, on the original idea. Mm. Because people have to be there some time to get into the workings of a battalion, to accept the rigours of what they had to do on exercises and drill and discipline and respect authority, which a lot of them probably weren't used to.
Do you have any idea of roughly how long it would take them to assimilate and become part of the unit themselves?
I wouldn't like to hazard a guess now, but it wasn't too long. It depended on what the battalion was doing. I mean, I think I mentioned in Greece, I was sent off with my company into the hills for a couple of weeks. Now, that was worth 6 months in barracks, because they came back, a lot of them having been pushed to doing things that they never dreamt they were capable of. And it gave them a sort of a little feeling of superiority and confidence, which they had probably lacked before. They'd also got to the stage where they were helping each other and digging trenches or carrying weapons and helping one another, which they hadn't had to do before. So there was a sort of growing confidence between them and each other in that 2 weeks, which would probably take much longer in barracks. So it very much depended on what they were doing, I think.
When they were at Warminster, were they being challenged there by the requirements of working up to demonstrations and so on? Was that creating this team, having this?
Yes, because they had to be absolutely perfect at it. In fact, I'm sure that on some occasions they must have got bored with with going out and practicing it over and over again.
You can be over-rehearsed.
Well, it can be over-rehearsed, yeah. But I think we got into a slot where you did the same the same people did the same demonstration for the same courses. But it's not a place, I think, where a battalion should stay for too long. I mean, it was still there when I left. And it hadn't been there for a year when I left. But I would imagine normally a battalion's regiment would stay in one place for 2 years, sometimes three, depending on what was going on. But I wouldn't have thought they should have stayed. They oughtn't have stayed there for 2 years, absolute maximum, because you then get into the habit of just doing demonstrations, which you practiced, and everybody knows what to do, and then they become stale.
Very important to avoid boredom when you're dealing with
Absolutely, yes. Well, of course, being in the UK, they could go. They had leave to go home, got railway warrants. There was also plenty of towns. Salisbury wasn't far away. Recreational transport was available so many times a week. So we got them out. I know we had, there were sort of, well, it was naffy there, I suppose we call that, having a good time. I know we arranged dances on occasions for them, where we got some local ladies in, sort of local racks and nurses and so forth. We had a dance in the officer's mess, which was a brainstorm of Dennis Roster, I think, one evening. I remember I had no female particularly in tow at that time. We all had to invite a partner. I had no female in tow at that time, and I'd met some girl, I remember, at home in Kintbury, who was staying with local family. I'd only seen her once, and I wrote and asked if she'd like to come, and to my astonishment, she didn't even query it, she came. But she was the daughter of a retired naval captain, so she was well in with knowing what the services were like. She stayed, this is a funny story here, because she was staying with a chap called Captain, also retired naval captain, Spicknell, who had been on Beatty's staff in the First World War at Jutland. And he was now gentleman usher, I think, to the king. And he used to go off on a train when he was summoned to go to London from Kintbury Station. And I remember standing on the platform there once. I wasn't there because he was there. I just happened to be there. And as the train was sort of just starting up, his family arrived. He got two daughters and his wife, brandishing swords, medals, and God knows what, and stuffing them through the train window as the train was stealing out of the train.
He was going to change the compartment.
Yes. They were a great family. They were great fun. But this dance went off very well, and everybody had. And I remember Jimmy Adams, our second in command, his wife, put her up for the night. They each one put one of the partners up for the night. And then, of course, we did all the old dances, which you don't get now, like Valita, Foxtrot, Waltz, Polka, Aitsons, Gay Gordons, all that sort of thing. We had the regimental band there, which we kept on, not exactly force-feeding with beer, but had their bit of beer, and finish up with the conga going all the way around there. Place outside and inside. It was a great success. I hear they had another one a year later, so I heard. So those sort of things helped with what could have been boredom, I suppose. John Kitto, Captain John Kitto, who was my sort of buddy there, we had the same sort of sense of humour. He got together a pack of beagles. But they weren't beagles, actually. They were sort of a collection of any dog he could get hold of. And to see this lot in pack in full cry was the most amusing thing. You've got little tiny dogs, big dogs, hairy dogs, smooth dogs, all yapping and barking. And I remember one occasion standing on top of the hill, and they came and went out with the CO to watch the see what went on. And this pack, we could hear them yapping from some distance, and they appeared over the brow of the hill, all rushed past us, some faster than others. And ringing up the rear was old John coming over the brow of the hill with yellow stockings, panting away. And after the dogs had gone past, I suppose I ought to call them hounds, which they weren't, had gone past, a hare appeared from the same direction they'd gone, walking quite peacefully back to where they'd been. It was a kind of comical.
They must have missed it.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think they ever got one. But John was very keen on his beagles. That's his way of getting over boredom. Well, another thing we did, of course, when we got back to the UK, and we probably did this in Bury St Edmunds as well, is to reinstitute the business of calling on locals. Which reminds me that when I first joined the regiment, when I first arrived at the depot, I was expected to call on all the married families. Before anybody would invite me or do anything, you had to go around with your, I had to get my cards done. And then you go around and present your card, and somebody would come to the door, and you'd say, "Is somebody in? At home?" And then they'd disappear and say, if they didn't want to see you, they'd say, "No, they're not at home." Or you'd be invited in, and then you'd spend 10 minutes, quarter of an hour having a pleasant chat. And then they'd then say, "Well, come back and have some drinks on another occasion, or come and have tea," or whatever it was. In the case of calling on people, married families in the barracks at Worley, they didn't stand on so much ceremony. You just called and they got the sherry out straight away. But when we went some to Bury St Edmunds and Warminster, there was a list of people who we should call on, which was handed down by the previous regiment. It usually consisted of local dignitaries, if there happened to be a mayor or somebody in the district.
Notables.
Notables, yes. The vicar. And then there were all kinds of ex-service retired colonels, brigadiers who had to be called on as a matter of form. And then there were the ones who were going to be of help, had tennis courts, young families who you could go and have fun with, or anybody who had been a help to the regiments in the past. And I remember I was with David Carter. We had to wear bowler hats and suits and everything else, and went off with our cards and did some calling. Then we had cocktail parties in the mess when we invited all these people back again, so to speak, if they'd invited us out to play tennis with their daughters or whatever. Because once you'd started, once you got in, then it was a question of just
carrying on,
yeah. So far as we were concerned, that was relieved, you know, help with an afternoon off here and there. Well, I think that, there was one other event there. I don't really remember Kenzie Comerford Green, Colonel. He was my DS at Haifa. Well, not, he was one of them. And he appeared again at Badenhausen in the MS branch there. I got quite friendly with him. And he was from the Wiltshires, and they were stationed at Devizes. And I went down as a guest, one of the guest nights there. He was great fun. Then I invited him back as a guest to one of our guest nights.
How often did you have these guest nights?
Well, I think we used to have a what was called a guest night once a week when we put a full fig on and had all the formalities. But I think we only invited outsiders once a month because it was quite a business with outsiders coming, and depending who they were, if they were somebody senior, then you had to put on a special show for them. But I think about once a month. But then, of course, if there was nobody to invite, you didn't do it. It depended who was there. I mean, obviously, your brigadier had to be invited, and any other. We had at Warminster, we would have had one or two across from the school.
Presumably the commandant of the school.
Oh, commandant.
Yes.
Who was, trying to remember his name, he became Furbank. He became, I don't know what they call it, Major General Infantry in the War Office.
Director of Infantry
in the War Office later.
Yes.
And then, of course, the chief instructor was the one who was did most of the work with us. He was the one who gave the instructions as to what was needed and what was required, and he was our sort of liaison there through our second in command, Jimmy Adams. They worked together. But then I think it was about April, I was sitting in my office, may have been March, I can't remember. I got a call from the military somebody in the military secretary's office in the War Office. Because my two-year tenure with Bedford's was nearly up. And he said, well, your next staff, you're going up back on a staff job, and we put you forward as G2 to the Commonwealth Division. So I thought, well, that's great. And I said, thank you very much, put the receiver down. And about two or three days later, he phoned up and said, look, I'm terribly sorry, but the general who's going to command the Commonwealth Division has got his own nominee for G2.
Which general would that be?
Well, Castles, I think we said last time. Mm-hmm. I thought it was West, but on reflection, you were right, it's Castles. I think that a general West took over later. I think I got this name West in my mind, I don't know. Anyway, it's Castles. So I said, we'll look for a good job in the Middle East for you somewhere. So there was nothing happened for a week or so. And then the MS phoned up again and said, how would you like to go to the Caribbean? I said, the Caribbean? Love it, sir, yes. Delighted. So not knowing what he meant or where the Caribbean was. So he said, well, we've got you down as G2 to headquarters, Caribbean area, as he called it. So I said, right, thank you. When would it be? And he said, well, you're moving in June, which would be your 2 years. So I didn't hear any more, much more about it. Then it was confirmed in writing. And then I sort of got the atlases and things and tried to find out where I was going. Found out that I was going to Kingston, Jamaica. And the headquarters of the Caribbean area, which covered the whole of the Caribbean, all the way from Bermuda, down through Bahamas, Jamaica, right down to British Guiana, and then out to the Leeward Islands, as the Navy would call Leeward Islands, I think, and Barbados, and then there's the other Windward Islands. So it was quite a big diocese.
Did it include Belize?
Yes, British Honduras as it was then.
Yes.
Yes, it did.
So you've got the Central American territories, South American territories,
that's right.
And the islands in the basin.
That's right.
So it's a vast area.
Terrific area.
Diverse.
Yeah, did a lot of travelling. So, anyway, this came through, and I was given a date to go on leave, embarkation leave. And I don't think I got a date for sailing because it was the banana boats which one had to go there in. So I had to wait for they had to wait until they got a suitable boat to get me there. Before I left, the sergeant's mess very kindly gave me a little farewell party in their mess, which the CO came and one to others. And then I was dined out in the officer's mess. Where Ross Dennis made a little speech, I made a little speech, and then he very kindly made me an honorary member of the Bedford and Hertfordshire Association. And then you're not allowed to give gifts, apparently, to departing officers unless on retirement. But he put his hand in his pocket and he brought out a couple of cufflinks with Bedford dress buttons on each with a little chain in which they've been made up in some. I got them here actually. I've had them ever since. See, they've got the Bedford
badge or crest.
Yes, yes. Well, they come off the mess jacket. Oh, yes. They need cleaning too. But I still wear them.
You're strongly made.
Yeah. So ended what was really two immensely enjoyable years I spent with them, and I did a job which I had liked and was to my liking because I was right in the middle of it and it kept me occupied and I had to use what little grey matter I had. And I suppose that was probably one of the best jobs I had whilst I was in the army. So before leaving, there was one character there who joined us, Major Pincher Martin. He was called Pincher, but his name was Martin. And he was an incredible character. He'd been with the Paras. He was a born bachelor. I can see him. He was very spare. He had a sort of slightly coloured, darker colour face, although he was pure English, I think, lined face. I could see him walking about in the desert in Arab gear on. He introduced me to string shirts, I remember, string vests, which I've been wearing. But I heard afterwards, he was quite a character, actually, Mark Pincher. He always, every time, and everybody said, I said, dear boy, it'll all be the same in 100 years, you know, someone was complaining about something. And I heard that he went off to the Arab Legion as a, I'm not sure, but I think he was a battalion commander under a Glub Pasha, which would have suited him absolutely down to the ground, I'm sure. So I'm sure he was a very happy pincher there. So, and then the last person I said goodbye to was the order room sergeant, because Brace had gone, and his name was Fincham, order room sergeant. He hadn't been there long enough to be made up to warrant officer, so he was still a sergeant, staff sergeant, I think. And I went to say goodbye to him, and he said, something about us getting on very well, which we had. And then he said, of course, he said, I would have preferred it had been a Bedford officer. So I said, yeah, all right, I quite understand. But he was a Barnardo's boy. I don't think he had much family. He'd been with the regiment some time. It was his home. And he didn't like intruders from outside very much. Although he wouldn't have thought it whilst I was doing the job. He was perfectly amiable, did the job respectful, did the job well. We got on well together. We made jokes together. But when it came down to it, he wasn't happy about not having a Bedford officer. And the other person who the only other person who made this sort of had this attitude was unfortunately the colonel of the regiment himself, General Denning.
You were saying that he refused to receive you.
That's right. Dennis Roster came back having seen him. And all he said to me is, it's no use, he won't see you. And he didn't say who it was, but I knew he'd been to see Denning, so that was that. Didn't worry me very much, I could understand. And I didn't, you know, it was obviously going to be an embarrassment if I had been come to see him, I suppose. So I eventually left behind me Nook Camp, motored home in my old second-hand Minx car, which I had. And during my embarkation leave, I remember one of my jobs was to try and trade in my old Minx for a new one, which I could get delivered in Jamaica without duty. And this eventually I managed to do. So I hopefully had arranged for a nice black painted, as it was, I had in those days, Hilmer Minx, the other end, when I got there, which it was. So I can't remember very much what I did and leave. It was summer. I suppose I went walking in the down the towpath of the Avon Canal and across the Berkshire countryside. Eventually I found myself on Kintbury Station, dressed in my, I can remember to this day, dressed in my service dress with my trunks piled up beside me. My mother and father were there. I had no brothers and sisters. I was just an only one. So there wasn't anybody else. It was a lovely English summer's day, and the whole of the Berkshire countryside from where we were standing on this little sort of platform with nobody else there, it's a little sort of halt. The whole countryside was bathed in sunshine, and I began to look around. I had this horrible feeling coming on me, so I really want to go and leave all this and go abroad again. But then the train came in, so I had to get on board and shove my stuff in the guard van and go to Bristol Temple Meads, where I had to change trains and go down to Avonport, what do they call it? Avonmouth, that's right. Where I embarked on a banana boat called the Aliguani.
We were the only soldier on it.
Yeah. There were not an awful lot. I can't remember how many there were on it. But there were mostly people going back to Jamaica, having been on holiday, Europeans and Jamaicans.
At that stage, did you know anything about the job you were going to be doing when you got to the other?
No, side? Not really. I know it was G2. Headquarters Caribbean area, but I didn't know. I had no idea of what the. In fact, it was the thought went through my mind at some stage that I was going in the wrong direction, because I felt, well, I'm going west, which looks like going into a sort of back of beyond with nothing going on, nothing happening. Of course, when I found out later, that was nothing could be further from the truth, and that all the action was going on to the east. And I had a little feeling of guilt, I suppose, that I was going in the wrong direction. But then I told myself, to cheer myself up, that it was only a small contingent in Korea anyway, and that most people say, well, if they want me, then they'll ask for me. And well, they did ask for me, and then it was turned down.